Parkland Hospital has been advised to stand by for a severe gunshot wound. I repeat, a shooting in the motorcade in the downtown area. Parkland Hospital has been advised to stand by for a severe gunshot wound. The president's car is now going past me. The limousine is now traveling at a very high rate of speed. Secret Service men standing up in the limousine. They are armed with submachine guns. It appears as though someone in the limousine might have been hit by the gunfire. Put me on, Phil. Put me on.
This is Bob Young, and I am seated across the table from James D. Eugenio, who has just come out with a brand new book entitled The Assassinations, Probe Magazine on JFK, MLK, RFK, and Malcolm X. Jim, it's good seeing you again.
Well, nice to see you again, Bob. It's been quite a while.
Yes, we talked after your first book came out, Destiny Betrayed, back in 1992. So just in time for the 30th anniversary. Now we're just in time for the 40th anniversary of John F. Kennedy's assassination in Dallas, November 22nd, 1963. Jim, where did this come from?
Well, the book is basically a compilation of the best essays that we published in Probe Magazine from about 1993 to 2000. But there's also some brand new stuff in the book. For example, the chapter on Malcolm X was done specifically, you know, for this particular edition of the book. David Mantic wrote with Cyril Weck a wonderful essay on the search for what happened to John F. Kennedy's brain. That's a new essay in this particular book. So there's about five or six brand new essays. The afterword is also new. So it's basically a compilation plus some absolutely new work.
And you worked on this with Lisa Pease. Is she a fairly well-known researcher as
yeah,
well?
Yeah, Lisa has her own website called Real History Archives. All right, and she was a very strong advocate of the declassification process. And she basically co-edited Pro Magazine with me. And she also, for people who pick up the book, she did two absolutely terrific essays on the Robert Kennedy assassination, for this particular volume, which I consider among the best things ever written on that case in an essay form.
Well, she also came up with two rather interesting articles for the JFK section about that notorious figure, James Jesus Angleton.
Correct.
Of CIA.
Counterintelligence chief.
Yeah, who was just about maybe one of the most creepy creatures that the U.S. government has ever put out publicly.
That's actually giving a lot more credit than I want.
Yeah.
Creepy is like too kind.
He was a dangerous man.
Yes.
He was an extremely dangerous man. And, of course, he was a bit of a pet of Alan Dulles.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, he actually, at Alan Dulles' funeral, he actually carried Dulles' ashes. To the gravesite.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
He seems awfully fond of funerals overall, Angleton did.
Yes.
Yeah,
he shows up in a lot of them.
You know, the Wynn Scott case and
right.
all of that. Anyway, before we leave the audience completely behind, John F. Kennedy, of course, was shot to death in Dealey Plaza, November 22nd, 1963. This is the one irrefutable fact that we have been presented with.
Correct. And, of course, Jack Ruby did shoot Lee Harvey Oswald. We know that also.
That's pretty obvious because we do have film on it. And
right.
if it's on tape, then you know it really happened. So, when did this begin? Because there seems to be this pattern of forming Lee Oswald to do this job, assuming that he actually did it, which is still a matter of great conjecture.
Mm-hmm.
Where did Lee Oswald come from?
Well, this is one of the... One of the sections in the JFK section of the book is entitled Who or What Was Lee Harvey Oswald?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very proud of the work that we produced in that. You mentioned half the section concerns Lisa's wonderful essay on James Angleton and his role with Lee Harvey Oswald and his role in the cover-up of Kennedy's assassination. And the other half of that section is this absolutely spectacular two-part essay by a guy named John Armstrong, who spent literally 10 years, the last 10 years of his life, researching who this guy really was. And his essay in this book, in my opinion, sets a whole new plateau for who was Lee Harvey Oswald, or a better question would be, what was Lee Harvey Oswald?
Mm-hmm.
All right, exactly what was he? And John, tell you a little about John. John is a multimillionaire, okay, who's made tons of money in oil and real estate, so he doesn't have to work for a living. So he literally spent 10 years of his life, 10 hours a day, studying who Lee Harvey, traveling all over the country, you know, tracking down new witnesses, getting them on tape, sent a whole office in his 10,000 square foot home with documents piled up chronologically in order of this phenomenon of Lee Harvey Oswald. Now, as he describes in the book, once you put everything together chronologically, you come to this rather unavoidable conclusion that there had to have been a doppelganger, whatever you want to call it, a double, okay, for Lee Harvey Oswald, because in simply too many places, he's in two places at one time.
Mm-hmm.
All right? And so, so therefore, after tracking down the witnesses who actually did see a second Oswald, he came to the conclusion that they weren't deluded, that they weren't, you know, bonkers, you know, that they weren't, you know, unreliable, that they were actually quite credible. Mm-hmm. And so after five, six, seven of these, plus the documents which you cannot refute, all right, he came to the conclusion there were really two Oswalds. And for the purposes of this essay, he calls one Lee and one Harvey.
Mm-hmm.
And unlike most of the research up until Armstrong's work, it wasn't just a few months before the Kennedy assassination, all right? Because everybody who has read anything in this field knows that there were some unmistakable impersonations of Lee Harvey Oswald prior to the Kennedy assassination in the summer and fall of 1963. For example, you had the incident at the shooting range. Okay, that's actually depicted in Oliver's film. You had the incident at the Bolton Ford incident, all right, where somebody called Oswald, you know, took a car ride out, testing a car, you know, and several other ones like that. But Armstrong traces it back even further. He comes to the conclusion that there was a double for Oswald as early as the 1950s in New York, when Oswald went up to see his brother John Pick and attended school there, all right? And what he says is that you can actually differentiate between the two. That's why he calls one Harvey and one Lee. The real Oswald was about 5'11", about 180 pounds, a kind of bull neck, okay, kind of athletic in his appearance, whereas the other Oswald, who he calls Harvey, was probably about 2 inches shorter, much more slender, about 140 pounds, with a skinny neck, small bones, okay? And this guy, Harvey, is the guy who's proficient in Russian. Because one of the mysteries that Armstrong's essay finally solves, in my opinion, is how did this Lee Oswald pick up this extremely difficult language, Russian, to the point where when he goes over to Russia, some of the people he talks to actually think it's his native language.
Or yeah. that at worst he's possibly from Georgia or Kazakhstan,
right.
One of
the southern states.
Right.
Right. Okay, and so the Warren Commission told us that he listened to Russian records and read Russian magazines, which of course is ludicrous, all right?
Considering the difficulties of the
yeah.
Cyrillic language in print,
right.
Yes, I would say that's pretty silly.
You know, and then, of course, then there was the story that the Warren Commission knew in private, but they did not tell us that he went to this so-called Monterey School of Languages. But even allowing, say that he did go there, all right? I've been to language schools, all
mm-hmm.
right? And it's difficult enough to catch on to be able to speak a language, a Romance language, which is much more easy, like French or Italian or Spanish. It's difficult to learn those in a few months to where you can speak them fluently. But to say that the guy picked up Russian, which is certainly one of the most difficult languages to learn, all right, in a period of a few months, again, that stretches the imagination. So this is one of the things that that the essay by Armstrong solves.
Well, there's also this problem for those who are not really familiar with this case. Lee Harvey Oswald was a Marine or at least someone claiming to be Lee Harvey Oswald was a Marine, who got a very odd medical discharge or a hardship discharge because of the mother's accident, which isn't
the candy
borne
box
out.
Incident,
right? Which isn't really borne out by investigation, but he used this occasion, being discharged from the Marines, to promptly turn around and go to the Soviet Union,
right,
which at the time was an extremely difficult, occasionally costly process.
Right.
And we're talking about a kid who didn't have money, didn't have the kind of background that would even suggest something like this. And then he spends a couple of years in Russia working at a radio factory.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, of course, he's spotted a number of times in the United States.
Once
while
in Florida.
While he's supposed to be in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Is this pretty much what set Armstrong loose on him, the fact that there were all these conflicting reports?
There's that when I talked to John, that was one of the things that puzzled him, that he was spotted so many times in the United States when he's in Russia. But the thing that really troubled him was the testimony of Palmer McBride, a guy who's supposed to know him in New Orleans, when he's actually not supposed to be in New Orleans, or if he is in New Orleans, he's not supposed to be at the place that Palmer McBride says was his house. So he actually went down to talk to Palmer McBride, all right, and he spent like 3 days with Palmer. And after interviewing McBride, see, one of the ways that it's really good to test witnesses in this case is their recall of certain details that might seem incidental. But what they do is they vouch for that the guy really was in the place where he said he was and really would have known the things that he should have known. So he actually said that when Oswald was there, they went to the opera house, all right? And he even recalled the name of the opera. So John went back to all the newspapers, all right, and checked it out. And he found that certain symphony or opera was actually playing at the time McBride said that it was actually there.
So bearing him out. Yeah,
right,
absolutely.
Yeah. And he did that with two or three other incidents that McBride testified to. So those are the things that put Armstrong on the trail of this so-called the second Oswald. The other thing is the school records.
Yes,
that
yes.
Don't match up. You know, that you couldn't have been going to school at this place when he's supposed to be going to school at this place.
Mm-hmm.
All right? And he couldn't have been going to two different junior high schools, you know, at the same time. There's the story about Frank Cudlady, who says that that he went to Monig Junior High School, and he should know because he was a principal, all right? But there's, if you look in all the records of the Warren Commission, those things aren't there. He went to interview Cudlady, and Cudlady said either the day of or the day after the assassination, the FBI swept down into the junior high school, okay, and confiscated all the records they had on Oswald. And they disappeared, okay, forever.
And there's never been any explanation of where these records
no.
took off to.
No, I mean, I think I have a good idea where they went to, but there's
yeah.
been no official explanation, okay, of where they went to.
Death don't have no mercy in this land. In this land, yeah. Come to your house, you know he don't take long. You look in the bed this morning, children, find that your mother's gone. I said death don't have no mercy.